So I have Facebook. Facebook. Do I say it to touch your things every?
Hello.
Hello. What did you say about me?
Around. Have you already used your topic?
I have to take it my topic and have the same.
No, I'm just looking at the. Okay, so you are considering you have something in mind?
No, I have talked with Barry.
Okay, who?
He suggested me some topics.
Okay.
Not all of them are here.
But we still have to support the last. Anyways.
Don't put your fingerprints on this glass now. Just go right there.
You're getting cold. Just nagging.
Okay. Finally, a topic which I really like.
That he says for everybody.
No. Today it's all about contrast. Contrast.
Yeah. It's all about contrast. Did you say that?
It's always.
Yeah.
It's
true.
But you like it.
I like it.
Yeah.
That's right. Ah, you noticed that. Oh, then you have learned something.
Heavy. Exact question. So what contrast?
Huh?
What does Peter like?
What is it all about?
No, but by contrast and visual acuity, and the presenter, I don't need to introduce him. He is your boss.
And yes, Ollie, stage is yours.
Okay. You. So, we. Microphone is on. You've got everything, so I won't mess it up like last time. So, what would be cover? Basically, what Peter said. So, introduction to visual acuity, definition of contrast, measure of contrast, contrast enhancement, contrast sensitivity, and basically how we collect the subjective data sets. So, this is basically what we would cover. And then we'll start with visual acuity. So, basically, our English-speaking friend, what does acuity mean?
Sharpness, ability to perceive, you know.
You're reading from up there. Anyway, so acuity. We should definitely ask for an English exam from you guys as well. Acuity is simply defined as sharpness, keenness of thought, vision, and hearing. And basically, visual acuity refers to basically clarity in vision. And then, so if you go into the doctor, what they would refer to is that a normal person with a normal vision would have a visual acuity of 6 over 6. Or if you're from the U.S., 20 over 20. But do you know what that means?
Meters over feet.
Yeah, but what does it mean then? What's 20 out of 20? Or 6 over 6? So that basically means that you are able to see something from a 6 meter distance the same way as somebody with a normal vision can see in distance of 6 meters as well. Or 20 feet. So the first number refers to the distance of in meters the same as what a person with normal vision can see. So the first one, red one, is what you could see. And the second one is what a normal person could see. And if you're 6 over 6, then you're basically okay. Or 20 out of 20. So, keeping what we mentioned, which one of the three has basically the best visual acuity? And if you go to Menti, enter that code, then you'll see options. I think there's one person or two person missing. But anyway, so this was, anybody else? Done. I could potentially stop it somehow. Sure. Anyway, so that's, so 12 over 6 was the one that most of you mentioned. So a 6 over 3 basically refers to an observer could see what a normal person could see from a distance of 3 meters, from a distance of 6 meters. 12 over 6 is that basically you could see basically what from a distance of 6 meters, what somebody could see from, what normal people could see from a distance of 12 meters. and then you could see something from a distance of 12 meters that somebody could see from a distance of 6 meters, but no paper. So basically the last one is the better, I'm not sure better is a good option, good word, but basically you could see far, far away compared to no meters. Then this is also basically an example. So you could see 6 over 6 on the top left, 6 over 18, so you need to, you could see what normal people see from a distance of 18 meters away from a 6 meter distance. So you see that it's starting to get blurry. 6 over 120 and 6 over 500. I'm not really sure what we could, a normal person could see from a distance of 500, but this is basically the simulation that we have. Then, I'm guessing you have, I'm hoping, you have all seen this Schnell test chart, and that's something that we use a lot in our experiments as well. So what we do a lot in our experiments is that in the subjective experiments that we have, we want to check that our observers are able to basically see. So we don't, we would not be running experiment. If somebody is wearing the glasses, we would ask them to wear the glasses when they're doing the test, because that's their normal observation sort of condition. But we would run a lot of these tests just to be sure. How could I formulate it that it doesn't sound wrong? So when we run a lot of subjective tests, I'm hoping you have already participated in a few. If not, then you should probably be receiving emails pretty soon. Is that we do so many subjective tests that basically everybody knows that I'm, for instance, not colorblind and I could basically see everything with my glasses. So there's a good chance that they would not run the experiment on me. But in general, if it's a new use, new observer, or if it's something new, and blah, 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 they would try to do it as well. And it's important that you have good observers for your experiments. If you just willy-nilly select anybody without going through the standard process, that you're sure that your observers are seeing basically what you're showing them. Or it's not a matter of observers seeing what you're showing them, it's a matter of everybody seeing the same thing. And if you're not sure, then that experiment is not basically reliable. Because we're evaluating something subjective and we want everybody to basically be able to see what we're showing them. So it's a fair ground for everybody. Then we have these Ishihara tests. So again, if you go to this 3297-4014, I'm hoping you should be able to rate. If not, let me...
Is it the same code?
Yep. 3297-4014. So there's 7 people who have already answered. 13 people, 14 people... 15 people. Everybody answered? Okay. And it's 74, and everybody answered 74. Next one. Don't cheat. Peter's like really looking for somebody who's colorblind in the last few years, and he was not able to find anybody. Okay, 16 people, 42. That's correct. There's one more chance, Peter. Keep your fingers crossed.
He already
tested us. Oh, you have?
Yes.
When did you test it? Okay, and then 16, everybody said there. It's 6. Then, let's see. Okay. And then this is the previous one that I showed you. So those ones are basically the classical Ishihara tests. But recently there have been new versions as well. So if you continue on the same fame. On the same, you could basically enter three different names for the three different people that are being depicted in the image. This is when we start feeling old, that they don't know who these people are.
Is it Bono?
There was a correct... No, okay, there's still one correct answer. Who's Chris Evans? No, I didn't say you put it. I'm just wondering. No, I was looking at Peter. Do you know who Chris Evans is?
He's one of the Chris's. He's an actor. Yeah. Yeah. Is he the guy who plays Captain
America? Yeah, yeah, it's the guy.
Yeah, he's not a very good actor, I will say.
No idea. Okay. So, these are basically...
Oh, whoa!
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Do you know them at least now?
Yeah.
Okay. We've got somewhere. So it's, I think it's Elton John, Bruno, and John Lennon. There you go. So an example of, so we would talk about running this. We would wait. So we would go for a subjective experiment that we run, and it's a really long experiment. But a way to basically make life easier for the subjects and make the experiments basically enjoyable is to try to come up with these ideas. Mm-hmm. Because just asking for numbers, if you start asking for numbers for like 1 hour, that's totally boring. But then you've got to be sure that at least they know who these people are. Then, well, that's where I got the images. And then for basically colorblind people. They're the same or they're different? He's wearing yellow. That's good. There is a red.
What colors?
What was that cucumber thing? I mean, only I can tell. Nobody else got to that.
Ah, wait.
Oh, there's the next one?
No, yeah, wait.
She already...
I already finished. Take all the markers out.
I don't want to take them all.
Don't take them out. You can see. But anyway, so you see how basically colorblind people see. So in most cases, it's a matter of inaccurate perception of the colors red and green. And you could see an example of them here. And you've got glasses as well to basically try it out.
Mm-hmm.
I just put it to the back.
Give it to Nikolai and we'll speed up the process.
What are you setting?
Okay, so now that you saw what colorblind people could see, then you hopefully see that it's important that everybody could see the same thing. Otherwise, when they're evaluating things, then it's a mess of experiments. So if you show one image to two different people and two different people see different things, then it's basically you can't use the ratings that they give in a subjective experiment. Then, let's see. And then to check basically your vision, we start with these sort of, we need to do the measurements in a high contrast environment, or at high contrast levels. And then, I covered contrast in the course, so you should hopefully know a bit. But in order for an object to be distinguishable from its background, there should be differences in luminance or color of the object compared to its background. So basically, an object and its background, there should be a difference in the luminance level or in the color level, so it's distinguishable for an observer. And then that level of difference, that's the contrast. That's what we refer to as contrast. And later on, I will show you a few formulas for how we calculate contrast. So contrast is determined by the difference in the color and or brightness of an object and its background. And contrast sensitivity is one of the most important measures done in the field of vision. So contrast sensitivity is basically our ability to distinguish between the foreground and background. And so different individuals have different contrast sensitivity. That's why we do lots of tests to figure out people's contrast sensitivity and chromatic contrast sensitivity and so on. And basically around the age of 20, you get to the maximum point, and then it would stop dropping down. And over time, due to age and different factors like cataract and so on, you would get, your contrast sensitivity would start to come down. And then basically this is what you would see. You could basically see, again, that this is what, so high contrast image, really low contrast image. And then basically we want to measure the contrast sensitivity of observers. So using that contrast sensitivity, we could have all these different methods and techniques. So if we know that once, again, I would show it later on, but if one region in the image has low contrast, so observers are not sensitive to changes around there, then you could basically do a lot of watermarking and everything over there, for example. So we talked about contrast, we talked about contrast sensitivity, and now it's a contrast sensitivity function. So contrast sensitivity function is basically measuring the contrast sensitivity as a function of the spatial frequency under a single viewing condition. So as you could see here, we've got different frequencies of the changes, and then we've got different amplitudes. So the contrast changes this side, and then the frequency changes on this surge. And then it's clear that in the case of a sinusoidal fluctuation from medium frequencies, a lower contrast is observed compared to high and low contrast frequencies. So basically, it looks more or less like this. And then this is basically what we would have, the contrast sensitivity obtained. Keep in mind that we're talking about a grayscale sort of thing. We're not talking about colors right now. And there's lots of different ways to calculate this for different people. I would mention one way that we did it for chromatic contrast sensitivity, but just to give you an idea about... So a way that they did it in for astronauts. So they basically gave them a tablet with this on it, and when they were up in the space, they asked them to basically, just with their hand, draw where they could start distinguishing, not distinguishing, so where's the border. So it could be as simple as that, or a lot of sort of long experiments to find out the exact point. Then, so, as I mentioned, so the no difference zone, that is basically regions that you can't detect, and then there's this basically regions of difference or where detection is done. So you could play around here, and there's a good chance that your observer would not be able to detect the changes over there. Then, yeah, that's, so it's a band pass between 2 and 8 cycles per degree, and I would tell you what cycles per degree is later on. But as I mentioned, spatial frequency changes around here, so it increases. And the contrast sensitivity measurement is done over here. So that's where the amplitude changes. So if you hopefully remember from a minute ago, this is basically the contrast sensitivity in the luminous channel. And then we do calculations for contrast sensitivity in red, green, and then blue, yellow as well. So when I mention red, green, it's basically... this black and white is replaced by red-green, and I would show you examples of it. And the red-blue is basically, blue-yellow is basically the other. Then, another thing that changes is basically the direction that you see. So you could see basically the sensitivity based on different directions. And by that, see, I can't prepare it. So you have, let's say, white and black, for example. And then when I mention directions, it's basically this. So basically when this changes, our sensitivity towards basically seeing it changes as well. So contrast sensitivity changes with regards to the angle, as you could see here. And then we are most sensitive in a 45 degree. So, and then there's different ways to find it. One way is basically to calculate the visible threshold. So that's basically the point that you see something. Something is with the, basically the change is visible or not visible. So you start to play around, and then you start increasing. And then when you get to that point, that's where the contrast sensitivity values are. So then this visibility threshold is equal to 1 over the contrast sensitivity. And as I mentioned, to measure it, you basically increase the amplitude of a simple grating stimuli under the stimulus as long as visible. So it's not visible, you start changing it until it gets visible. But as much as it might sound easy if you're just changing the volume, it would not be as accurate if you're just playing around with a button. So there's lots of long experiments that I would talk about later on. So, influential factors and contrast sensitivity. So, spatial frequency we talked about, orientation we talked about, light adaptation level we talked about, the image area with image area, viewing distance, retinal eccentricity. So, your contrast sensitivity in different lighting conditions would be different. How big or small the patch is, for example, that would play a role. How far away or how close you are, that would play a role, and so on. So basically, a lot of it has to do with viewing conditions. And then, how do we describe a stimuli? And then, so what we do is that, as you see up there, so we basically show different cycles. And when I mention cycles, is basically maximum dominance next to minimum dominance. So maximum dominance next to minimum dominance, that's one cycle. And depending on basically the viewing angle that you have, then you would basically have these cycle per degree representations. So for example, in the figure below, you have 10 cycles here. You have a viewing angle of 60 degrees. So then you basically, your spatial frequency is basically 10 cycles per over 60 degrees or 0.167. So that's the spatial frequency we talk about. And then if you change the angle, so if the change in the distance would naturally change, result in a change in the angle. So then, for example, in the case of a 45 degrees, you would have an 0.222. So it's again 10 over the 45 degrees that we talked about. Then, so for calculating this chromatic contrast sensitivity function, there is a lot of different issues that we need to take care of. I would leave this mentee for between the break that you should basically go to that website, run the program one. If you have a mobile phone, run it on your mobile phone, and then run it once more on your laptop just to see how different results you would get because of basically the calibration of your cameras and how calibration of your displays and how basically it's not calibrated. So you would see how it works. It's basically finding the square which does not has a different contrast number to the other ones. Then let's see. So issues that we need to take care of when running the test is basically the display condition. So basically, now I'm going for sort of an example of a subjective test when we are trying to calculate the chromatic contrast sensitivity. So what I did back then was basically go through all these different displays that we had, calculate the color difference in a display. So basically, this is our display, calculate the color difference, for example, between here and here. Here and here, here and here, basically everywhere in the screen. And then, after you do that for like a few weeks, then you find out that no screen is basically good enough. Then you buy a new one. But even the new one is not good enough. So then you need to decide what you want to do, and you select the one which is less, which is the best among the worst. But nothing is uniform, even the expensive ones. That's one issue. And then it's not a matter of just spatial uniformity, that this is here, but it's a matter of time as well. So a display which is basically could basically change over time because of how long it's run or it's heating up and so on. That's why a lot of times they basically recommend that keep the display on, for example, for an hour to warm up. So but then at least you have a better idea of having a better chance of having a more uniform display. Then room conditions. So basically you want to limit the light sources in the room so you don't have like a light shining on the display or light basically reflecting from some surface and so on. So normally what we do again, turn off the lights in the room. It's a dark room. Cover all the places so there's no reflection at all. So the subjective test design and first initial measurements. So you want to do lots of measurements. You need to do lots of pilot studies at the start. So then you would not waste the time of your subjects. And then you want to make the observers engage. In this experiment, it took 8 hours to do. So if an observer, but first of all, the observers didn't do it for 8 straight hours. You need to break it down. And even then, they get bored. So like the colorblindness experiments that I showed you, you want to make them engage, you want them to be less bored. So for example, in the case of this experiment, which took around 8 hours, what we did is that, I would show the experiment, but we were showing different color patches, asking the observer if they could see it or not. And then if they were giving the correct answer, which I would show you later on what I mean by correct answer, they would hear a different noise than a wrong answer. So they're basically competing with themselves, or at least that's what we hope. And then we also inform them about like how many patches they have seen and like how many is left and so on. So again, just try to let them know that things are progressing. It's not stalled. But this was basically the setup that we had. So as you can see, we've covered everywhere. So then when you turn off the light, there's basically least possible sort of reflection. You could see that even the mouse pad is basically black. Then, let's see. Then we have a display.
So have you used different cycles per degree?
Yeah, wait. Then we basically use this red, this circle, and then the other part of the screen is basically black. So black is the display, and then this blue part is basically the black cable that we put around the screen. Any idea why we did that? Are you awake? Yes.
Make the contrast between white and black?
No. This is the setting. We would show the things in the circuit. But why are we doing that? What did I talk about this?
What about the color difference? Because like that area is like has like smaller color difference.
Yeah, that's a good point. So that's one point. Because this is basically the most uniform region we could find out. Then, if you remember, I mentioned that there is a difference between the viewing angle, the angle of the patches. So I mentioned like 0 degrees or 45 degrees. Mm-hmm. What does this have to do with that? Now, so let's do it another way. So if we have a display, display is basically pixels. Pixels is basically a checkerboard. So basically, let's say each of these squares is basically R, is 1 pixel. So if we want to show white and black, so for example, this is black, this is black, this is black, and then this would be basically white. So that's for the 0 degrees. If we want to, I'll do it here with another color. So if I want to turn this to white, if I want to basically 45 degrees, then I have to do this, do this, do this, and then I would have this, for example. Mm-hmm. Then what would be the problem then?
Probably out of the area, like...
No. Keep it in the area. Don't worry about the area. Yeah, she's
not
going
uniform,
there.
Like,
yeah, it's not uniform
it
anymore.
Edges.
Here, it's uniform. Here, you see this jagging. Because I would be talking about jagging in next lecture that I have at 3 as well. So, in image processing. But there's this jagging problem. And then, so how could we solve that? How could we keep it straight, but have a tilted patch?
By rotating the monitor?
Hmm?
Yeah.
Or rotating the observers.
Or rotating the observers.
That's easier.
So basically we have this black cardboard, but then we could basically turn it this way. So then we would have, that would work. So now we've got a 45 degrees, but it's rotated, and the observers would not know that it's rotated because they can't see the screen behind the black cover. So basically, they're not really affected by the rotation of the display. They're just evaluating the patch itself. What would be the problem then, other than the display?
How did you rotate it? Like, no. I know. Like, generally, it takes time. And like.
No, they don't see everything at the same time. They see, like, for example, the 0 degrees, then the next session that they come, they would see a 45 degrees.
How to control it with the mouse?
Hmm?
How to control it with
there you go. So the mouse is a problem. Because the mouse is not rotated for 45 degrees. But the thing is, 45 degrees is not that big of a deal. After like 1 or 2, they figure they basically work easy. They think there's something wrong with the mouse. The problem comes when you go 90 degrees. Then everything is a mess. That's why we didn't do 90 degrees. Okay, I lost my screen here. But anyway, what's next? That I showed you. And then these are the patches that we showed. So you could see that basically we have different frequencies that we are showing them in the same, basically, behind. So, and you can see that it's basically increasing over time. So, what we do is we're using green and red. So that's the chromatic contrast we're trying to evaluate. We ask observers to evaluate each of these 7 different frequencies. And then, basically after they finish one, they start the second one, and then they start the third one, and then they start the fourth one, fifth one, and so on. And, I could say this because that's something. So, first of all, the order that different observers see is different. So that's randomized. So one observer could start with A, then B, C, D, blah, blah, blah. Another observer could start with G, F, E, D. Another observer could start with B, F, C, whatever. And it's important for that to be random. Because then you're sure that the order that they're seeing is not basically affecting their scores. If different observers give quite similar results,
when they've seen it in different order, that basically shows that the order did not play any role in when they were evaluating. That's one. Then,
what is the time? Do you want them to take the break now?
Yeah, what's the time?
It's 10, it's 1:57. Okay, then what?
That fits into your story.
Yeah, it fits in my story. Then if you go to that website, then basically play around with it while I'll figure out what's wrong with this.
Is the mouse a problem when you use the screen or just the keyboard controls? If the mouse is a problem, why don't you use the screen or just the keyboard?
I'll tell you why later on. You've got to wait. No, because you see when you see the task that we give them, then you'd see that we need the mouse. Wait. Okay, something is happening.
There's a trick to it for getting a really high score.
I bet you rotate your screen.
No, you need to jump up and down after each other. It's not rotation, it's basically playing around with the brightness of your screen.
I already increased that.
Do it once with your cell phone, once with your laptop.
Nick, you're doing it all.
Yeah.
So where is Parshant?
He was carrying some banking issues, I think.
So I'll start in 2 minutes if you want to go get water or whatever.
Okay.
So I'm hoping you have seen that you basically give different scores on different devices. More or less, you're the same. You're the same person. The viewing conditions are more or less the same. The only difference is basically getting the distance and the screen that you have. So it's basically, again, another parameter that you need to take care of. We talked about basically your visual acuity. We talked about basically the color blindness, and then different devices as well would have a problem. So that's why there's always this tricky question of should we run subjective experiments when it's something that it depends on your personal sort of taste and evaluation, online or not. So if you basically see different things and you use different devices, would it be okay if we show you the same image in two devices and ask and expect you to basically repeat your score, for example, for image quality? What we did last semester was there was a master PhD student who did her PhD on basically trying to calibrate the screens visually. Then at least then we have a better hope that chances of you and somebody else saying the same thing would be quite close. But still. So Then I could just close this and then move to... So, I talked about this. So, what we did for the experiment is that we predefined, I think it's 25 different locations on the screen, and each location is basically shown as a red square. So there was a 1 in 25% chance that that color patch would drop inside one of those squares. The thing was that the observers did not see the square. The observers just saw the circle, and there was a color patch somewhere here. So they didn't know there's 25 predefined locations. And then what we asked them was basically click on the region of the screen which they could see the color patch, which they think the color patch is there. That's why we needed to use a mouse, not a keyboard. Because there was a... Basically, one of those places, the patch would be shown randomly somewhere on the screen, and then the observer had to basically click on where they thought the patch is. And if they clicked on the right direction, the contrast would drop, and if they didn't select the right direction, right location, the contrast would increase. So, as you could see here, basically, this is how things basically drop. So, normally they select, because the first patch is basically the most clear one, everybody would see. Then there would be a high drop in contrast. Then there's a good chance, for example, they would not select the right one. Then there would be an increase, and then here you could see that it basically takes, they go, like, for example, down, 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 and then there's a bump because they did it wrong, until we reach a stable point. The way we calculated these steps, so from here to here, from here to here, and all these other steps, is a method called Quest. And that is basically how, that is, it was initially created for contrast sensitivity, basically calculations, but you could use it for many other things as well. But the idea behind it is that there is a reward and there is a penalty. If somebody selects the right location, then they are rewarded, and the reward is a drop in the contrast level. If they don't select the right direction for the location, there is a penalty, and the penalty is basically an increase in the contrast level. So that's why you see the unstableness until you more or less get to a place that every other click is basically right or wrong. What we did is that the observers took 110 patches for each of those color patches that I showed you. So for each of them, they had to basically do 110 evaluations. And that took around, if I remember correctly, it took around half an hour or so. That's why it was an 8-hour experiment. Because they did it for all the 7 color patches for 0 degrees and another round for 45 degrees. So, and then, let's see. What other things should I tell you? So when I mention running a pilot study, the reasoning behind it is that, since it's a long experiment, I think what we did is that we asked the observers to come for a 1-hour period, and they did it for basically either 1 hour or 2 hours. So they were basically deep down around here, or even like around here. And our initial thing was that they could basically, let's see. So each of these patches would show randomly, then they would select it, and then the next thing that they would see could be any of these patches. So we were doing all the 7 of them in parallel in 1 or 2 hour sessions. If I remember, in 2 hour sessions. But back then I was in Paris, so I was running things remotely here in the Color Lab. But what we did was that Marius was basically participating in the experiments. Like, he would come back 10 to 8, participate for 10 minutes, then go do his job, come back like the next day, do a 10 minute, come back next day. So he was doing in a 10 minute race. And then the problem was, if you remember, I told you there is a penalty and there is a reward. So
every time that he was leaving, Quest was basically understanding that he has given a wrong answer. And since there was like 7 different patches as well, he basically didn't get down to anywhere around here. So he was always up here and just giving results and results and results without reaching anywhere. So that's why you basically need to do pilot study, because without a pilot study, there was no chance we would figure that out. So you need to do lots of different pilot studies. You need to basically get people participating, figuring out all the possible things that could go wrong. Because if, I think I looked at his results after like 4 or 5 sessions, and then we found that's the problem. If we didn't find that out, then he would have been wasting a lot of his time, and the others would more or less be wasting their time as well. Because although they were doing it in the 2-hour sessions, so they were somewhere around here, but still, they were not here or where we wanted them to be. So, result-wise. So, you could see the results for different frequencies at for different observers, so each symbol is one observer, for different frequencies at 0 degrees. So you could see that they more or less follow the same sort of pattern that we showed earlier. But there is difference between observers. And then, like, for example, it's interesting to see, like, this green cross and this black circle, they are more or less the same here. They're more or less the same here and here, but then they are different around here and here. So basically, high frequencies, they've got differences. Then we have it for the 45 degrees as well. Keep in mind that the symbols in the 0 degrees and 45 degrees do not correspond to the same person. So green in this could be somebody different in the other. But you see some small differences between sort of 0 and 45 degrees. And then this would basically be the average value between all the observers and the standard deviation of their values as well for 0 and 45 degrees. But sort of what we found is that basically observing the contrast sensitivity values between different observers in both vertical and oblique orientation shows similar bandpass shapes in the log-log coordination. So you see they more or less follow the same pattern. The average contrast sensitivity for 0 and 45 orientation based on the average observer results in similar looking curves. And in the case of oblique orientation, by the lowest standard deviation among the contrast sensitivity seen in higher spatial frequencies, low spatial frequencies also show close contrast sensitivity effects. Another sort of a reason that we did this is prior to this, there was only one data set which was on chromatic contrast sensitivity. There was only 2 observers in the test, and then among the 2 observers, only one observer had done it for all the spatial frequencies, and that was the offer. Because it takes a long time to do these measurements, so then it's not easy to basically recruit people to participate. So that was.
Can you say it again? So this is one observer.
No, this is 8-9 observers.
Ah.
But prior to that, there was a work published in 1989, which everybody basically referred to that and did all their sort of future works, basically all their works based on the assumption that they got there, and it was just on one observer.
And that is the average of 8 observers.
This is an average of 8 observers.
Is the
difference?
Yeah, the inter-observer repeatability between them. Also.
Yeah, but the thing is, do we need a repeatability? Because it's something totally subjective. Do we want, and then the repeatability is taken care of.
Interesting to see it's how these 8 differ.
Yeah, that's the standard deviation between them. So you see the standard deviation is quite lower in the 45 degrees. So you could say in the lower ways that it's lower. But anyway.
Okay.
So,
something that I mentioned, so consistency in the display. So what we did is that for each of these points, we basically calculated the color difference between red, green, blue, black, white, gray, between different locations and also over time, so over 24-hour time. Then, what else? Contrast measurement itself. So we talked about contrast sensitivity, but then there's different ways to measure the contrast in a given image as well. And for doing that, there are global metrics. So basically, you have an image, and then you come up with one single contrast value for all the image, independent of what the image is depicting. Or you could have local ones. So obviously, the global one would be less accurate than a local one, because you could have anything in that image, and then there's one single score. And so the simplest way is basically dividing the maximum luminance in the image to the minimum luminance in the image. Then the Weber contrast is basically maximum minus the minimum divided by the minimum. And the Michelson contrast is basically not this. L max minus L min, that would be one all the time. So that's a wrong equation. Then, funny how I have presented this for 3 years and nobody has figured that out.
Yeah, we said that all the time.
No, nobody said that. There's something else that you guys didn't see. This is what they saw last year, after like 3 years. After we published it and referred to it, and everybody had seen it as well. So, as I told you again, even I make mistakes. Then we've got the local contrast. So, in the case of local contrast, then it's basically calculating the contrast values on different, basically, windows that we have. And then for this, you could basically use any of the three here. And then there is a retinal light subsampling contrast, which is basically, then it takes into account different contrast values at different LAB channels as well, with different weights. Well, for more information, you could basically say this, or we published something as well 10 years after that, so in 2020. Then,
so we talked about contrast. In the image processing course, we also talked about contrast enhancement, but that was like really easy on a grayscale image. But there's lots of different methods for running a contrast enhancement on a given image. And here you could see basically some of them. So the first one is basically the original image, and then the rest of them is basically different contrast enhancement techniques applied to the first image. As you can see, they do differ. So they are different, and they even work differently on different images. It might be that they work good in one image, and they work less good in another image. But then the top one is from one paper, or one data set, and the bottom one is from another data set. And then, what do you think? Yeah, there's something wrong. It's not wrong, but there's a drawback here compared to the one on top in how we are representing our results.
What is it?
All of the pictures on the third line are the same.
But why is that? There are different methods. Some of them are even methods that are shown up there. You are in the right track. They look really similar, but why is that?
Because the picture and
colors
are not that bright.
No, necessarily. The problem is that the data set that we have, those images up there, so the reference image, the one on the left, on your left, here, they are low contrast images. So when you apply contrast enhancement, you see the change. This does not have a problem with contrast enhancement. So when you enhance it, then basically the other ones don't really look different as well. So when you're collecting a data set for a specific task, use the chart to collect good images. We did all this, and then I was looking at the results, and that's the problem that we have. So if you want to create a data set for contrast enhancement, then you need to have images which need to be enhanced. If they're good enough, what's the point on like increasing the quality when nothing shows up? And then that would make the life for the subjects hard as well, because normally you have a set of images, you run different contrast enhancement techniques, then you go and show to the observer that this is a reference image, this is a contrast enhanced version, how good or bad is this compared to this? When the original and the enhanced version are really similar, then that makes life hard for the subject as well. Then, what else do I have? Nothing else. Questions? That's it. Finished. I need questions now.
Questions?
Everything was that clear?
I guess I just had a question related to the experiment. Did you only perform the color contrast sensitivity test with the red-green? Do you think you would notice any differences if you did blue-yellow?
What do you mean, any differences? Any difference between observers or any differences with regards to contrast sensitivity?
With regards to overall contrast sensitivity.
Yeah, because you do... It is different. Then your question would be, how did you do that? And the answer is because it takes a long time. So even like this green, red took like 2.5 years to get it done.
What data is this based off exactly? Because I just remember you had that anecdote about how there wasn't a lot of data on...
So when I say there is one data which is public. That's the one that people could use. Then there's these smaller things that are not public, but they basically have these results. And then another thing is, this is not something just for the image person people. There's lots of people who work on vision, psychology, and so on, which they also use this as well. But the black and white one are the one that everybody does. It's a lot faster. Yeah.
So in this graph, we see that there is a difference between color contrast sensitivity and just the black and white. Why is that, at least like the first part of the diagram, there is an obvious difference between them. How can that be like explained?
Do you have an answer?
I was somewhere else now. Could you repeat?
How could you explain that gap, that here? This huge difference here. Other than having something to do with our visual system, I don't have an answer. But Peter knows a lot more of this.
No. So the black is the
black
is
light. Yeah.
And then the red, green, and yellow one.
I'm just thinking out loud on the spot. Here. So, basically, this is the first thing we show the observers. This is basically what you see at this side of the graph. And then, let's see, where am I going? This way. And then this is what you see there as well. So this looks basically grayish, while that red-green is not really grayish, or blue-yellow is not that grayish. But that's just a wild guess right now. But keeping in mind that something else I forgot to say is that we basically show all the patches on a gray background because we don't want the background to have any effect on the observers as well. Again, I'm thinking on the spot. But probably, if you remember... What we showed, that part in a black and white, was basically gray itself as well.
So that's why there's basically nothing there. Observers cannot see.
Okay.
Right, they could see the color. But physiologically, I don't have any idea.
Grayscale, then that's understandable to have a background of gray.
Mm-hmm.
But if I am talking about a contrast between a green and a red,
mm-hmm.
then shouldn't the background be the combination of those instead of being over a gray?
So the thing is, when you So you see, when you bring down the contrast and you increase the frequency, it basically turns into gray as well. So gray is basically the neutral background. That you want to put all that in, I think, in any subjective experience that we have, gray is what we use. Because if you use other colors, then that background could play a role in the observer's sort of understanding.
I know about the neutral background,
mm-hmm.
but I'm wondering, if I look at it from far away, that I can't see the stripes,
mm-hmm.
then would I see a gray?
You see a gray.
Wouldn't I see some
no.
yellow?
You see, great. That's why people would not be able to see it there. I was trying to run the experiment, so
but she has a valid point.
Yeah, she has a valid point.
To see also with all the white background and also black.
So.
But then the curve would look different.
Yeah.
Because when it's grayscale and then you're looking at it, the background kind of.
Yeah.
Diffuses,
mm.
but like now I can see them. Even if the border is not distinct for me,
mm.
I still get some idea from
mm-hmm.
the contrast between the patches and the background.
Yeah. I don't have any answer, but I know there's lots of work on that. And are you coming back here for the third semester? That could be something you could do in one of your course projects, and I'm not joking.
No, that sounds actually really nice.
Yeah, that's the experiment is there. You just need to change the background and run the experiment.
And have a lot of time.
Hmm? Have all the fun, yeah.
A lot of time.
Not necessarily. You could just do it for two single frequencies, and then you could even... So after I did this, I think that a year after, Vlado started another version, which that was quite faster. And something Olga is doing right now is that she is working on image quality for individual observers. And her goal is to basically... She wants to show an image to the observer and then only change one single property in the image. Let's say contrast. So she wants to change the contrast level for an observer and then see what is the optimum contrast value with regards to image quality for an observer.
Mm-hmm.
And for doing that, she would more or less do the same sort of a... It's not exactly quest, but it is something similar. So instead of allowing people to tune things, which is not the ideal case scenario because you want it to be repeatable, then it's a matter of just increasing, decreasing, increasing, decreasing until you basically reach a sort of a stable point. So there's lots... And then... Especially for this, the main question is, where should you start? Because if you start in a high contrast image, that would result in a difference than in a low contrast image and so on. And what she's planning to do is basically, initially for the first image, it's basically random. But for the second image, she could basically get some prior information from here. And then for the third image, she would get prior information from them, so it's a more educated guess than a random thing. The same thing could happen here. It's basically learning and then trying to decrease the number of
mm-hmm.
patches. But that is a topic you, at least in John's course, this advanced color imaging, that's something you could use. You could have as a project. And I know me, John, and Marius would be more than happy if you take such a project. More.
Was there also a kind of a of
2 or 3 seconds
between each stimuli?
No, 2 or 3 seconds, that would be a lot more. It was in milliseconds. It was already an 8-minute thing.
No, because
so then it would be around 1600 times whatever second that you want to have.
Okay.
picture.
Yeah, but there, it, there thing, yeah.
You know?
But it's basically a gray screen with a plus sign in the center. So basically, they select somewhere, they hear if it's wrong, right or wrong, depending on their right or wrong, as I mentioned. They could hear two different sounds. Then there's a gray screen with just a white cross in the center for milliseconds, and then we move to the next one. It's, as I said, it's 1600 patches. Then even if you multiply that by 2, that would be, how many would that be? Divided by 60. 31, that would be 3, that would be 800. Then divide that would be 200, or this, times 2, that would be another 400 minutes.
Sure.
We don't have time, but after image is something that you need to take care of anyway, in most subjective experiments. Marius has already given them the presentation, hasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Marius has already presented them.
Yeah.
Did he talk about Quickevac?
Quickevac.
Ah, okay.
Mentioned.
So if you look at Quickevac, then you could also decide how long you want that after image issue be taken care of. Other questions? Didn't solve it. They just got used to it after like a few clicks.
How about using a touch screen display?
Yeah, imagine if you had a touch screen display and everybody had a dirty hand, and then they would leave the thing. So, yeah, and then a touch screen which has a really good quality. I don't think it's available, and if it's available, it's really expensive. But we are buying a new ISO HDR, which is 30,000 euros.
30,000 euros?
Mm-hmm. Instead of the screen, but above the touchpad. But then that's the same problem.
That's basically a mouse.
Probably you can change like the cursor into something like more neutral, like circle or something.
To be honest, that wasn't the biggest problem that the experiment had. Because they just needed to click on somewhere. The problem was in when we were wanting to rotate it for 90 degrees. For what? For what?
That's
a good idea. But there's a few problems. Eye tracking is not as exact as you want. It's not precise. Then second is, if they see it, then what should we do? How do we know that that's where they've seen it? They blink twice. And if they blink a lot, then it's basically uncalibrated as well.
How about labeling the sample and then you just press the button
That's longer, and then that's not what we want as well. We don't want them. They initially didn't know there's 25 locations. It potentially could be anywhere. So then you're basically giving them places to look at. You don't want them to find the place, to know exactly where to look at.
But eye tracker, I like that.
Yeah, eye tracker is a good idea.
But also to study kind of the region which has most attention.
Another problem with an eye tracker is that it's in a dark room. Eye tracker doesn't work exactly good even in a bright room, let alone a dark room.
But eye
tracker is always a good thing. I have been trying to use an eye tracker from 2000.
The timing.
Yeah, the timing is there.
So there must be a function between the contrast and
the amount of time it takes. Yeah, but the thing is, so we now that we've done it for like, I think at the end we did it for like 10, 12 people, and then 7 of them participated in everything. There are people who just want to find it, and if they don't find it, they give up. There are people who really spend time to try to find it. So then, although we have collected the amount of time they spend, it's an individual sort of a thing as well.
Yeah,
So you and I could spend different amount of times per clicks, and so we can't use an average clicking time, for example.
Yeah, sure.
Could add value to the result.
Yeah, well, we collected a lot of information that it's still there. If somebody wants to process it, more than welcome. Yeah, the contrast would increase. No, there's no other chance. Well, because it's a matter of if they see it or if they don't see it. If they don't see it, they don't see it. And then they get penalized, so the contrast increases, and then the contrast starts to drop again, so they would end up with the same place they have been, unless they can't really see that contrast. That's why you can't just come down to one point and as soon as they just pop up, then you say that's the point. You need them to repeat a lot of times so you're sure that that is the place. Other questions? That's a really sort of a good excuse to lie down in the class. So if anybody else wants to lie down, you have a talk with Nick. He'll take care of it.
So next week, we're going to have five lectures. So in addition to Tuesday and Wednesday, Friday afternoon, the last will be online due to Mackey Discourse in RIT.
All right, Smacky Dis.
Okay, then I do not have anything to add right now. Okay, thanks, Ollie.
Thank you.
Very good.
And then I would see you guys in half an hour in B210. Yeah. I'm sending you the
where is the
it's there.
Okay.
Are there any items otherwise up there?
It's
Yeah, so you could talk.
I sent an email yesterday and just a lot of things. Is it possible to
organize? And then today I was able to get a paid
so you would, they won't send a PDF, yeah. But
I said I think there is a link while you're in the rest of the
okay.
Yeah, do that. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yo, or there was somebody else.
Your visual pool is connected to the folder you're running from, right?
Yeah.
So if there's a
free available software. And you have the same kind of infrastructure requiring ICC profiles with what's that on the
location question. So I think
no probably mistake.
He was thinking.
So I think that's easy. So I asked all him, I don't remember what was the he answered. It was not like, I do it. Was it to ask IT?
Yeah.
I need to, now we could have asked him again. But there was someone else who is using GIMP.
Mm-hmm.
So then, the ICC facilities are basically the same. So that's probably the fastest. Probably the only thing you need to check where to put the profiles. I'm not sure why I tested that already. Could be that GIMP also is checking the folder named color or color sync or that. So then my point is you need to put the profiles in a certain order probably, as you need to do with the Adobe. Sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that's. Have a look at the. That's probably the.
Yeah, because if it is open source, could be.
Yeah, yeah. So that's fine.
Yeah.
Sorry?
The image is sent to me by one camera and a split.
Yeah.
I should make use of those cameras and display in cloud.
Yeah.
Instead of the medical cameras. Is that still okay?
Yeah, so I don't know what the medical camera is about. Also, is that just a normal DSLR camera? Is that a medical camera or is it a black and white camera? I don't know what is a medical camera.
They use the ones they use in the surgical environment.
So the only thing I know that we have a number of DSLR cameras, Canon and Nikon. But for me, these are normal cameras. These are probably not distinct medical or surgical cameras. So these cameras we have available.
Okay.
So that was my idea. And unless you want to do something completely different, but then do we have these items available?
Yeah.
Then I don't.
Yeah, I think for the cost work, I think it's okay.
Yeah.
I will do those ones.
But so my point is, I think you need to suggest that to Phil. You need to elaborate a bit on the idea, what exactly you want to do with the camera and what you want to do with the display. That you propose that to fill in one of the next meetings before you actually start.
Yeah.
So that Phil is aware of what you're doing and he might give you some further suggestions before you actually start.
Yeah.
So
that you think through, you know, so okay, what is the aim, so what is how do I do the setup, what kind of color test chart do I capture. Then I have to admit, if you want to do a characterization of the sensor, also if you want to obtain the sensor sensitivity function, the unit to do that, also the monochromator, that is still in a box in the worker room. So that still needs to be taken out from the box and set up and connect and all this. I have not done that. Or maybe I can ask the lab engineer. Maybe I can talk to Markus. I meet Markus on Friday in the bunker room. Then I could talk to him whether he has time to set that up. So that, you know, that is a device with a white light source. And then you have black box where the light goes in that black box, and then you have a mirror system to change the direction of the light, and then it hits a diffraction grating, and the diffraction grating is a kind of a prism where the white light gets dispersed into different wavelengths, so you get a rainbow. Then the rainbow is then again is directed to a slit. A slit is an opening, and then you can choose, you know, the nanometer size of the slit. Then you can say, okay, give me 500 nanometer, and then it is approximately green yellow light that is exit the slit, and then you have a sphere. And that sphere is then illuminated with 500 nanometer. And then you capture an image with the camera. And that you need to do then across the visible spectrum. So then instead of 500 nanometer, you ask the monochromator, give me 400 nanometer. Then it provides 400 nanometer. Then you click with the camera, you take an image of this 400 nanometer light, and at the same time you measure with the telespectral radiometer the light of 400 nanometer. So then you have captured with the camera sensor, so you know the RGB signal from that light and the corresponding measurement. And then you do that 420 nanometer, 440 nanometer, 700 nanometer across the visible spectrum. Also that has been done before. There's a lot of paper existing for these type of characterization. And the other characterization is based on a color checker. You know, color checker is this physical size with patches, and then you have either 24 patches, or we have color patches with 120 patches, or is it 240 patches? 240 patches. So then you know the X, Y, Z of all these patches. You capture an image under a certain illumination, and then you know the RGB. And by knowing RGB and XYZ, then you can calculate the characterization for that camera. And that is then the other type of characterization.
So, before
you actually start, it requires to do some reading to get an understanding. There's no point starting with something without knowing what you're doing. That is waste of time. So you need to know why you're doing that and how you're doing that, and that you learn by reading author's paper. So this is nothing new that has been done hundreds, thousands of times. that takes time. That's the way it is.
Yeah, since it's just, I think, put a crosswalk and just, I just want to do something. And
no, so. So, you know, that is a kind of. That is also time management. So, you know, you have 8 weeks and you have other courses as well.
Yeah.
So then you need to think, okay, how much effort and time do I want to put into that? You know, as a, do I target an excellent degree, or do I target only a C, or do I target just to pass? So you have to think a little bit like that, you know, if you see that this is something you have not much experience and you need a hell of a lot of time to grasp into the details. So these are a lot of considerations that you have to make, and it's time management. But it is, I mean, I know it is. Things which it's not just a small project, so I know that he requires from student that you dig into the matter. But my point is, you know, if you have the camera and the display and you want to put that together and you see or you realize there is no time to do all this, then you have to think, okay, then I focus only on the camera, and then I do these two tasks, you know, with the two type of characterization. Do you understand what I mean? So that it's your choice, dependent on the time and dependent on your capacity and the time which is available to read. Things.
I will go through a way again and see, and then contact the field.
Yeah.
And then come up with a title.
Yes.
Maybe or send it deadline. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Time is flying. Do you have a subject for this course? Literature review.
Yeah.
You mentioned something also with medical.
Yes. Yeah, because
that's your area, isn't it? This DICOM and
robotics.
Robotics. Yeah. No, that's it's a lot of. Information and all that.
Literature story. I would do my best.
Good. That sounds good.
I'll do my best.
Yeah. Okay.
How about that class?
You have another class now.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Just need to wipe this. Okay, see you.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Thank you.